Chapter 10, Leading Up and Down the Chain of Command. Leif Babin. Camp Mark Lee, Ramadi, Iraq, leading down the chain of command. The night sky suddenly lit up like a laser show at a rock concert. Some distance across the river, U.S. security positions in the heart of Ramadi were under attack. Almost immediately, American sentries returned fire with a massive barrage from heavy machine guns, sending their own streaks of brilliant orange-red tracers back at enemy positions. Seconds passed before the distant rattle and boom of machine gun fire, mixed with intermittent explosions, reached us. As any military veteran knew, tracers were generally placed every fifth round in belt-fed machine guns, which meant that there was a hell of a lot of hot lead flying around in the darkness that we couldn't see. The distant firefight continued for some time. As Jocko and I watched, flaming streaks from the engines of an unseen U.S. attack aircraft, likely a Marine F-18 Hornet, appeared in the sky over the distant fight. Light flashed as a missile ignited off the wing, streaked across the sky, and exploded in a brilliant burst of light. Hopefully, they had smoked the enemy without any American casualties. It was all quite a show, but here in Ramadi, it was nothing out of the ordinary. It had been a still and clear evening until the distant firefight lit up the night. The baking temperatures of the Iraqi summertime heat had recently given way to a tolerable, cooler fall. Jocko and I sat on the dusty rooftop of the large three-story concrete building that served as our tactical operations center on the base that had been our home, Camp Mark Lee. Our SEAL task unit had been in Ramadi for nearly 6 months. Soon, we were scheduled to return to the States. With no combat operations pending that evening, Jocko and I had a rare moment to reflect as we looked across the peaceful, dark waters of the Euphrates River and the lights of Ramadi on the far bank and beyond. We reminisced about the combat operations our task unit had participated in and all that had happened here. Task Unit Bruiser had conducted hundreds of operations and endured many an onslaught from enemy attacks like the one we just witnessed. We had been in dozens of firefights, had thousands of rounds shot at us, shot back thousands of our own, and frequently called in fire support from U.S. tanks or aircraft. Our SEALs had done substantial damage to the enemy. Witnessing the triumph of success, we knew we had made a difference, but we also endured extraordinary loss. 2 months earlier, in the midst of a huge battle for the heart of the city, we had lost Mark Lee, the first SEAL killed in action in the Iraq War, and the man in whose honor we named the camp. Mark's death was devastating. It left a hole that could never be filled. The same day we lost Mark, another beloved Charlie Platoon SEAL, Ryan Job, had been hit in the face by an enemy sniper round. Ryan lost an eye and took substantial damage to his face. But we waited for hopeful news from the doctors that sight would return in his remaining eye. 3 weeks later, as he recovered in a hospital in Germany, those hopes were dashed when we learned Ryan would never see again. He was blind. This news was absolutely crushing. Then, just as our deployment came to a close, a Task Unit Bruiser SEAL in Delta Platoon, Mike Mansour, was out on what would likely have been his last combat operation before returning home. When an enemy hand grenade was tossed into Delta Platoon's position, Mike dove on top of that grenade, shielding his teammates around him from the bulk of the blast and sacrificing himself for them. Each of these fallen SEALs were beloved teammates, friends, and brothers. We would forever mourn their loss. On the rooftop that night, as Jocko and I talked about all we had been a part of in Ramadi, we knew Task Unit Bruiser had fulfilled a key role in the U.S. Army Ready First Brigade's strategy that successfully wrested control of key Ramadi neighborhoods from the insurgents. After months of effort and countless firefights, U.S. forces and their Iraqi Army partner forces now had a presence where they previously had none. They could now secure the populace from the savage insurgents who had long controlled most of the city. This and the foresight of the Ready First Brigade's leadership set the conditions for tribal sheikhs to successfully rise up against Al-Qaeda in Iraq and unite with U.S. forces in what would become the Anbar Awakening. Task Unit Bruiser was proud to have played a role in the Ready First Brigade's success. We had killed hundreds of insurgent fighters, helped to eliminate many of their safe havens, and deeply disrupted their freedom of movement. Now, with the Ready First combat outposts in place throughout much of the city, the enemy no longer exercised complete control over many neighborhoods of Ramadi. But the distant firefight we had just witnessed from the rooftop was a reminder that the enemy was still capable, deadly, and determined to fight back for control of the city. What lasting impact did we truly have here, I wondered. Soon afterward, we turned over our operations to the next SEAL task unit that took our place. Our time in Ramadi came to an end as the last of us from Task Unit Bruiser boarded a big U.S. Air Force C-17 cargo aircraft for the flight home. Once back stateside, it was quite a transition from the intense violence in the bloody streets of Ramadi to the peace and tranquility of San Diego, California. For many of us, it was an emotional return. After all the blood, sweat, and tears, the Task Unit Bruiser and our brothers and sisters in arms and the U.S. Army and Marine Corps had spilled there, I felt torn. We had lost the first SEALs killed in action in the Iraq War. As a leader, nothing had prepared me for that monumental burden I must forever carry for not bringing all my guys home to their families. If only I could trade places with them. When Ryan got shot and Mark was killed, they were doing exactly what I had asked of them. I was in charge. I was responsible. My fellow platoon commander felt the same way about Mike Mansoor. I knew Jocko felt that burden for each man. Hearing American pundits and the media talking about all the blood and treasure spent in Iraq, I reacted with fury. To them, the casualty figures were just statistics, numbers on a page. To us, they were teammates and friends, brothers. Their families suffered the greatest hardship. These men were deeply missed and painfully mourned. Others had been seriously wounded, and some would never fully recover. Their lives, and those of their families and friends, would likewise never be the same. The true sacrifices endured by the troops who fought this war were far beyond anything that most Americans could comprehend. Within our own beloved SEAL community, we heard the mutterings of criticism about our operations from the armchair quarterbacks in the rear echelon, far from the battlefield. They clearly didn't understand what we had done and why. They didn't witness the impact of our operations or the difference we had made. With angry emotion, I wrestled with how best to professionally respond to those critics, particularly from senior officers with no real combat experience. Part of me wanted to punch them in the mouth, but a bigger part of me just wanted them to understand what we'd accomplished and why. I knew that anyone who truly comprehended what Task Unit Bruiser had done and who understood the incredible victory the U.S. Army Ready First Brigade had achieved in Ramadi would respect not only the bravery and dedication of the troops, but also the strategic success, securing Ramadi and Anbar Province from the brink of disaster. It had been a monumental triumph for U.S. forces on one of the toughest battlefields anywhere, when many doubted we could win. The doubters have been proved wrong. Some within the SEAL community said we took too much risk, that our sniper operations were just playing whack-a-mole. Used to a paradigm of traditional special operations, they could not comprehend the adaptations we had made or the risk those adaptations held. Nor did they understand the nature of counterinsurgency and the spectacular reversal toward peace and security that had been achieved. Some of the politicians and most senior military brass in Washington felt that killing bad guys only created more enemies, but they didn't have a clue. Our lethal operations were crucial to securing the populace. Each enemy fighter killed meant more U.S. soldiers and Marines came home alive. It meant more Iraqi soldiers and police lived to fight another day. And it meant more of Ramadi's civilian populace could live in a little less fear. No longer could the enemy ruthlessly torture, rape, and murder innocent civilians. Once the local people no longer feared the insurgents, they were willing to join with U.S. and Iraqi forces to defeat them. Shortly after Task Unit Bruiser's return to the United States in late October of 2006, Jocko was asked to build a presentation for the Chief of Naval Operations, the most senior admiral in the Navy, a member of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, and a direct advisor to the President. Jocko took a map of Ramadi and built an overlay that depicted the geographic areas that had been completely under enemy control, Al-Qaeda battle space, when we first arrived. These were areas that, when I arrived in Ramadi, the SEAL platoon commander, who had spent the previous 6 months there, pointed to and said to me, "Don't go in there. You will all get killed, and no one will even be able to reach you to get you out." From this map of Ramadi, Jocko built a PowerPoint slide that depicted how the Ready First combat team seize, clear, hold, build strategy systematically through months of effort, established a permanent presence in the enemy-held neighborhoods, and pushed out the enemy fighters. U.S. forces and the Iraqi forces with them demonstrated to the people of Ramadi that we were now the strongest side. As a result, the local populace joined us and turned against the insurgents who had terrorized them. The slide depicted how Task Unit Bruiser SEALs had been the lead element for virtually every major operation to build a combat outpost in enemy territory and take those neighborhoods back. When Jocko showed me the slide he had built, it all came together for me for the first time. Though I had been directly involved in the planning of almost all of these missions, had been on the ground leading a team of operators, coordinated with the other elements on the battlefield, and had written detailed reports of what had happened after each mission, I still had not linked them all together, nor considered the strategic impact they had had. But now, Jocko's brief captured in simple terms all that had been accomplished in the Battle of Ramadi. This was a striking realization. I was Charlie Platoon Commander, second in seniority only to Jocko and Task Unit Bruiser, and yet, immersed in the details of the tactical operations, I had not fully appreciated or understood how these operations so directly contributed to the strategic mission with spectacular results beyond anyone's wildest dreams. "Damn," I said to Jocko. "I never really put it all together like that before." This one slide made it immediately clear why we had done what we had done. While this knowledge could never ease the pain endured by the loss of incredible SEAL friends and teammates, it certainly helped to put in perspective why we had taken such risk and what had been accomplished. As platoon commander, I had detailed insight into the planning and coordination with the Army and Marine battalions and companies that was far beyond most of the SEAL operators in my platoon. Yet, if I didn't fully comprehend or appreciate the strategic impact of what had been done, how could I expect my frontline troops, my junior SEAL operators not in a leadership role, to get it? The answer, I couldn't. For a young SEAL shooter with a very limited role in the planning process, who was out working on his weapons and gear, conducting maintenance on our vehicles, or building demolition charges for the breacher, he walked into our mission briefs wondering, "What are we doing next?" He had no context for why we were doing the operation or how the next tactical mission fit into the bigger picture of stabilizing and securing Ramadi. I realize now that as their leader, I had failed to explain it to them. Clearly, there was some level of strategic perspective and comprehension that would only come with time and reflection. But I could have done a far better job as a leader to understand for myself the strategic impact of our operations and pass this insight to my troops. When Jocko saw my reaction to the slide and the presentation he had built, he too realized that he should have more fully detailed the strategic impact of what we were doing and why. It was a realization for him that even when a leader thinks his troops understand the bigger picture, they very often have difficulty connecting the dots between the tactical mission they are immersed in with a greater overarching goal. Looking back on Task Unit Bruiser's deployment to Ramadi, I realized that the SEALs in Charlie Platoon, who suffered the worst combat fatigue, whose attitudes grew progressively more negative as the months of heavy combat wore on, who most questioned the level of risk we were taking on operations, they all had the least ownership of the planning for each operation. Conversely, the SEAL operators who remained focused and positive, who believed in what we were doing, and who were eager to continue and would have stayed on beyond our 6 month deployment if they could, they all had some ownership of the planning process in each operation, even if they only controlled a small piece of the plan, the route into or out of a target, the breach scene on an entry door, coordination with supporting aircraft, managing an assault force of Iraqi soldiers. Those SEAL operators still better understood the mission, the detailed steps taken to mitigate those risks we could control, the commander's intent behind why we were conducting that specific operation. The SEALs with little or no ownership were somewhat in the dark. As a result, they had a harder time understanding why we were taking the risks we were taking and what specific impact we had in the campaign to liberate Ramadi. Looking back, one of the greatest lessons learned for me was that I could have done a far better job of leading down the chain of command. I should have given greater ownership of plans to the troops, especially those who were negative and weren't fully committed to the mission. I should have taken the time to better understand how what we were doing contributed to the strategic mission. I should have asked those questions to Jocko and on up my chain of command. I should have put together a routine strategic overview brief and regularly delivered this to Charlie Platoon's operators so that they could understand what we had accomplished and how our missions furthered the strategic goals of stabilizing Ramadi and securing the populace. With the physical hardship of operating in Iraqi summertime heat reaching 117 degrees Fahrenheit, carrying heavy loads of gear, and routinely engaging in fierce firefights with enemy forces, the SEAL operators in Charlie Platoon needed greater context to understand why that was necessary. Seeing the Ramadi overview slide that Jocko had built, I now understood what we had done and, more important, understood what leading down the chain of command was all about. It was a hard lesson to learn, but one I will never forget. Principle: leading down the chain. Any good leader is immersed in the planning and execution of tasks, projects, and operations to move the team toward a strategic goal. Such leaders possess insight into the bigger picture and why specific tasks need to be accomplished. This information does not automatically translate to subordinate leaders and the frontline troops. Junior members of the team, the tactical level operators, are rightly focused on their specific jobs. They must be in order to accomplish the tactical mission. They do not need the full knowledge and insight of their senior leaders, nor do the senior leaders need the intricate understanding of the tactical level operators' jobs. Still, it is critical that each have an understanding of the other's role, and it is paramount that senior leaders explain to their junior leaders and troops executing the mission how their role contributes to big picture success. This is not intuitive and never as obvious to the rank and file employees as leaders might assume. Leaders must routinely communicate with their team members to help them understand their role in the overall mission. Frontline leaders and troops can then connect the dots between what they do every day, the day-to-day operations, and how that impacts the company's strategic goals. This understanding helps the team members prioritize their efforts in a rapidly changing dynamic environment. That is leading down the chain of command. It requires regularly stepping out of the office and personally engaging in face-to-face conversations with direct reports and observing the frontline troops in action to understand their particular challenges and read them into the commander's intent. This enables the team to understand why they are doing what they are doing, which facilitates decentralized command. As a leader employing extreme ownership, if your team isn't doing what you need them to do, you first have to look at yourself. Rather than blame them for not seeing the strategic picture, you must figure out a way to better communicate it to them in terms that are simple, clear, and concise so that they understand. This is what leading down the chain of command is all about. Camp Mark Lee, Ramadi, Iraq, leading up the chain of command. "You've got to be kidding me," I shouted as I burst into Jocko's office inside the talk. I was fuming. "Are they serious?" Our talk was located in a large three-story building on the bank of the Euphrates River, which had previously housed some of Saddam Hussein's senior military brass before the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. Now, the once elaborate building was battered and worse for wear. It was the centerpiece of our SEAL camp, just beyond the large U.S. forward operating base of Camp Ramadi at the edge of the war-torn city. Invading armies had camped along this very riverbank for millennia. Babylonians, Assyrians, Persians, Greeks, Arabs, Ottoman Turks, and British troops. Now, American forces, including Navy SEALs and support personnel of Task Unit Bruiser, were here for a time. I was furious and venting my frustration at Jocko. Unbelievable. How do they expect us to actually plan our operations when they are bombarding us with ludicrous questions? I asked. Jocko had just forwarded me an email from our higher headquarters staff, led by our SEAL team's commanding officer, or CO. The email in question asked for clarification on an upcoming operation that Charlie Platoon planned to execute in the next few hours. As one of two platoon commanders in Task Unit Bruiser, I was Jocko's direct report his immediate subordinate. Jocko reported directly to the CO, often through the CO's staff, who had sent the email. While Task Unit Bruiser was located in Ramadi, the CO and his staff were some 30 miles to the east in Fallujah, a city that had been cleaned up by the massive U.S. Marine offensive in 2004. Now, 2 years later, Fallujah remained fairly stable. It was a far different environment than the constant violence of Ramadi. Our operational plans required the CO's approval and on up the chain of command to the next level. The CO and his staff also provided many of the resources and support we needed to execute our missions in Ramadi. "What's the issue?" Jocko asked me, seeing that I was fired up. "The email?" He, too, was frustrated with the frequent questions and scrutiny. "Yes, the email," I replied. "Every little thing we do, they don't get." The oft-blamed they, in this case, was anyone outside of my immediate group of Charlie Platoon and Task Unit Bruiser. Jocko laughed. "I know you're frustrated," he said, "but I'm frustrated too." I cut him off. "It's actually insane. We are busting our butts, risking our lives, and kicking some serious ass on the toughest battlefield in Iraq, and I have to answer idiotic questions like whether we have a QRF lined up." The QRF, or Quick Reaction Force, consisted of U.S. soldiers or Marines who would respond with armored vehicles, a couple of dozen troops, and heavy firepower when our SEALs got into a serious bind and were pinned down by enemy forces. Many of us in Task Unit Bruiser had been to Iraq previously, and a few had seen some decent combat. On those previous deployments, activating the QRF was virtually unheard of, but here in Ramadi, it was a common occurrence. On any operation, at any time, we knew we could be attacked by an overwhelming number of enemy fighters and our position overrun. In just the first few months on the ground here, we, Charlie Platoon, and our brethren in Delta Platoon, activated our QRF more times than I could count. The email Jocko had just forwarded to me from our higher headquarters asked a series of questions that our CO wanted to know prior to approving our pending operation. One of the questions read, "Did you coordinate an appropriate QRF?" I found this question almost an insult. Do they really think we would do any type of operation whatsoever here without a significant QRF package fully coordinated and on standby? I asked. "We even set up QRFs for our administrative convoys. This is Ramadi. Going out there without a QRF would be suicide." Jocko smiled. Over the previous weeks, he had vented similar frustration to me, probably more so than he should have. We would privately laugh at some of the questions that flowed from our higher headquarters. On one recent operation Charlie Platoon had planned, we were asked whether mortars were a danger for us. Mortars, with up to 20 pounds of high explosives cased in half-inch thick steel, fell from the sky and exploded with a tremendous concussion that threw lethal shrapnel in all directions. Often, enemy fighters fired mortars with impressive accuracy. Mortars were a danger for us on every operation, even while sitting on base. We selected buildings with thicker concrete walls that could provide some protection, and we tried never to be predictable so the enemy could not anticipate our next move. Besides that, mortars were a risk largely beyond our control. We had to focus our planning efforts on the risks we could control. Jocko had been every bit as frustrated with some of the questions and shared that with me. But since that time, he had come to the realization that the frustrations we had with our superiors were misguided. The CO and his staff weren't bad guys out to make our lives harder and stifle our operations. They were good people trying to do their jobs the best they could and give us what we needed to accomplish our mission. But they weren't on the battlefield with us. They didn't fully understand the threats we dealt with on a daily basis and how hard we were working to mitigate every risk we possibly could. Still, this was combat, and there were inherent risks. In Ramadi, U.S. troops were killed or wounded almost every day. "We waste our time answering question after question," I said. "It takes effort away from our planning and preparation for the actual op itself. It's actually dangerous." Jocko knew I had a point, but he needed me to see beyond the immediate front-side focus of my team, Charlie Platoon, and understand the bigger picture. Jocko tried to calm me down and help me see our combat operations through the CO's eyes, from the perspective of his staff and the Special Operations Task Force. "The CO has to approve every mission. If we want to operate, we need to put him in his comfort zone so that he approves them and we can execute, Jocko said. The more we give them, the more they ask for, I fired back. They want an updated seating chart for our vehicles 5 minutes before the launch of every op, even though we have to make last-minute changes. They want the names of every individual Iraqi soldier working with us, even though I won't know that until just prior to launch. Jocko just nodded, realizing that I needed to vent. He knew I was a capable and already proven leader. He had trained and mentored me for the past year to prepare me for the rigors of combat operations and then unleashed me to lead Charlie Platoon on the battlefield. But he also knew I needed to see the importance of pushing information up the chain, beyond my platoon and task unit. I needed to understand how to lead up the chain of command and why it was important. The amount of information we had to gather and the required paperwork we were forced to submit just to get approval for each combat mission was staggering. It wasn't what people saw in war movies or television shows. Never in my boyhood dreams of battlefield glory had I envisioned such things would be required, but it was the reality. We know our combat operations are making an impact on the battlefield here. They are important, said Jocko. I nodded in agreement. Jocko continued, but all of these operations need the CO's approval. He has to be comfortable with what we are doing, and we need his support to get additional approvals from higher up the chain. So we can complain about this all day and do nothing, or we can push the necessary information up the chain so that the CO is comfortable and gives us approval. Jocko had a point. The CO and his staff were not here with us in Ramadi. They couldn't fully understand or appreciate the efforts we had made at risk mitigation and the excellent working relationships we had built with the U.S. Army and Marine battalions and companies that supported us with QRFs. We can't expect them to be mind readers, Jocko said. The only way they are going to get this information is from what we pass to them, the reports we write, the phone calls we make, and we obviously aren't doing a good enough job if they still have major questions. Well, they should come out here then, I responded. They should, Jocko answered. But have we told them they should or schedule a convoy to pick them up? I know I haven't, Jocko admitted. This contradicted popular thinking. Typically, the frontline troops wanted senior leaders as far away as possible to avoid questions or scrutiny on the smallest things like grooming standards and whether or not our camp was squared away. We are here. We are on the ground. We need to push situational awareness up the chain, Jocko said. If they have questions, it is our fault for not properly communicating the information they need. We have to lead them. They are in charge of us, I questioned. How can we lead them? This epiphany had come to Jocko in examining his own frustrations up the chain. Leadership doesn't just flow down the chain of command, but up as well, he said. We have to own everything in our world. That's what extreme ownership is all about. I nodded, coming around to his logic. Jocko's guidance had not yet steered me wrong in the year we had worked together. He had taught me to be the combat leader I needed to be, but this was a whole new attitude, a completely different mindset from anything I had seen or been taught. Instead of blaming others, instead of complaining about the boss's questions, I had to take ownership of the problem and lead. This included the leaders above me in our chain of command. We need to look at ourselves and see what we can do better, Jocko continued. We have to write more detailed reports that help them understand what we are doing and why we are making the decisions we are making. We have to communicate more openly in calls. When they have questions, we need to immediately get them whatever information they need so that they understand what is happening out here. I now understood. Far from simply trying to overburden us with questions, our CO and his staff were working hard to get the information they needed so that they could approve our plans, forward them up the chain for further approval, and enable us to launch on combat missions to get after the enemy. I needed to check my negative attitude, which was corrosive and ultimately only hampered our ability to operate. I now accepted Jocko's challenge full on. You're right, I said. I can bitch about their questions and scrutiny all I want, but at the end of the day, it gets us no closer to getting our operations approved. If I get them the information they need and put the CO in his comfort zone with what we're doing, we are going to be much more effective getting our ops approved, which will enable us to inflict greater damage on the bad guys and win. Exactly, Jocko said. From that day forward, we began a campaign of leading up the chain of command. We provided extremely detailed mission planning documents and post-operational reports. We pushed the understanding of this to our team leaders within the platoon. We invited the CO, our command master chief, and other staff to visit us in Ramadi and offered to take them along on combat missions. Our command master chief accompanied us on several missions. The more information we passed, the more our CO and staff understood what we were trying to accomplish. He better appreciated our detailed planning efforts, how we coordinated our quick reaction forces, and the substantial lengths to which we went to mitigate the risks. The CO grew more comfortable with our combat operations. He and his staff developed trust in us. As a result, all the combat missions we submitted received approval, which allowed Charlie Batoon and Task Unit Bruiser to deliver huge impact on the battlefield. Principle, leading up the chain. If your boss isn't making a decision in a timely manner or providing necessary support for you and your team, don't blame the boss. First, blame yourself. Examine what you can do to better convey the critical information for decisions to be made and support allocated. Leading up the chain of command requires tactful engagement with the immediate boss, or in military terms, higher headquarters, to obtain the decisions and support necessary to enable your team to accomplish its mission and ultimately win. To do this, a leader must push situational awareness up the chain of command. Leading up the chain takes much more savvy and skill than leading down the chain. Leading up, the leader cannot fall back on his or her positional authority. Instead, the subordinate leader must use influence, experience, knowledge, communication, and maintain the highest professionalism. While pushing to make your superior understand what you need, you must also realize that your boss must allocate limited assets and make decisions with a bigger picture in mind. You and your team may not represent the priority effort at that particular time, or perhaps the senior leadership has chosen a different direction. Have the humility to understand and accept this. One of the most important jobs of any leader is to support your own boss, your immediate leadership. In any chain of command, the leadership must always present a united front to the troops. A public display of discontent or disagreement with the chain of command undermines the authority of leaders at all levels. This is catastrophic to the performance of any organization. As a leader, if you don't understand why decisions are being made, requests denied, or support allocated elsewhere, you must ask those questions up the chain. Then, once understood, you can pass that understanding down to your team. Leaders in any chain of command will not always agree, but at the end of the day, once the debate on a particular course of action is over and the boss has made a decision, even if that decision is one you argued against, you must execute the plan as if it were your own. When leading up the chain of command, use caution and respect. But remember, if your leader is not giving the support you need, don't blame him or her. Instead, re-examine what you can do to better clarify, educate, influence, or convince that person to give you what you need in order to win. The major factors to be aware of when leading up and down the chain of command are these. Take responsibility for leading everyone in your world, subordinates and superiors alike. If someone isn't doing what you want or need them to do, look in the mirror first and determine what you can do to better enable this. Don't ask your leader what you should do. Tell them what you're going to do. Application to business. Corporate doesn't understand what's going on out here, said the field manager. Whatever experience those guys had in the field from years ago, they have long forgotten. They just don't get what we are dealing with, and their questions and second-guessing prevents me and my team from getting the job done. The infamous they. I was on a visit to a client company's field leadership team, the frontline troops that executed the company's mission. This was where the rubber met the road. All the corporate capital initiatives, strategic planning sessions, and allocated resources were geared to support this team here on the ground. How the frontline troops executed the mission would ultimately mean success or failure for the entire company. The field manager's team was geographically separated from their corporate headquarters, located hundreds of miles away. He was clearly frustrated. The field manager had a job to do, and he was angry at the questions and scrutiny from afar. For every task his team undertook, he was required to submit substantial paperwork. In his mind, it made for a lot more work than necessary and detracted from the team's focus and ability to execute. I listened and allowed him to vent for several minutes. "I've been in your shoes," I said. "I used to get frustrated as hell at my chain of command when we were in Iraq. They would scrutinize our plans, ask questions that seemed stupid, and load on a massive paperwork requirement that I had to submit both prior to and after every operation." "You had to deal with that as a Navy SEAL at war?" asked the field manager, surprised. "I wouldn't have guessed that." "I absolutely did," I said. "Before every combat mission, we had to get approval up the chain of command at least two levels from a faraway boss who didn't fully understand what we were up against. That required me putting the intricate details of the operation in a multitude of PowerPoint slides and then an additional Word document of several type pages just to get approval. Once approved and we launched, then I had to generate even more paperwork when we got back. A multi-slide storyboard brief with photographs and a detailed multi-page operational summary. If we killed any bad guys on a combat mission, which in Ramadi was virtually every operation, we had to provide sworn statements describing precisely what happened and how our actions complied with the rules of engagement for each enemy fighter killed. And that doesn't even include the pages of required intelligence paperwork we had to compile. I didn't figure you guys would have to deal with such stuff, said the field manager. No matter how big or bureaucratic your company seems, I said, it pales in comparison to the gargantuan U.S. military bureaucracy. And imagine how much more emotional and frustrating it is for us when our lives are on the line every day. I often work myself into a rage over some very similar issues to yours here. But we had two choices, I said. Throw our hands up in frustration and do nothing, or figure out how to most effectively operate within the constraints required of us. We chose the latter. Let me ask you a question, I continued. Do you think the company's senior executives at corporate headquarters want you to fail? The field manager looked puzzled. He clearly never considered the question. Could they be scheming about how to make your job more difficult, how they can keep you and your team flustered with questions, scrutiny, and paperwork, or how they might totally sabotage your mission? I asked. Of course this wasn't the case. Having worked with the company's executive team, I knew they were a smart bunch of driven, eager overachievers who wanted their frontline troops to not only accomplish the mission, but to eclipse all competitors and set the standard for the industry. No, they don't want me to fail, admitted the field manager. All right, I said. Then if they are asking questions, criticizing your plan, and requiring paperwork, it means they are in need of some critical information. When Jocko was my task unit commander, he had the same talk with me in Ramadi. That's what changed my mindset about this and allowed us to become more effective. What changed your mind? The field manager asked. I realized that if my chain of command had questions about my plans or needed additional information or more detailed paperwork, it was not their fault, I said. It was my fault. I knew we were making the right decisions and being careful to mitigate every risk we can control. I knew our combat operations were critical to achieving strategic victory in Ramadi. So if my boss wasn't comfortable with what I was doing, it was only because I had not clearly communicated it to him. The field manager looked at me, beginning to understand. So if they have questions, it's my fault that they didn't get the information they need? Asked the field manager. This completely contradicted his way of thinking and everything he had experienced in his leadership upbringing. That us-versus-them mentality was common to just about every level of every chain of command, whether military unit or civilian corporation. But breaking that mentality was the key to properly lead up the chain of command and radically improve the team's performance. Listen, the senior leadership at corporate headquarters wants you to succeed, I said. That's a given. It's up to you to inform them and help them understand some of the challenges you're dealing with here on the ground. If you have questions about why a specific plan or required paperwork is coming down the pipe, don't just throw up your hands in frustration. Ask those questions up the chain to clarify so that you can understand it. Provide them with constructive feedback so they can appreciate the impact those plans or requirements have on your operations. That is what extreme ownership is all about. I guess I never really thought about it like that, said the field manager. That's leading up the chain of command, I explained. The field manager came around to this realization. He accepted that he needed to do better in pushing situational awareness, information, and communication up the chain. If you think they don't fully understand the challenges you are facing here, invite your senior executives out to the field to see your team in action, I said. Over the following weeks and months, the field manager took a different tact with the senior leadership at corporate headquarters. He took the initiative to understand what specific information they needed and went overboard pushing that information to them. He also hosted the senior executives in a field visit to their frontline troops. It built camaraderie between the corporate leadership team and the field manager's operations team on the ground. The face-to-face interaction helped the senior executives understand some of the field manager's challenges, and the field manager's time with the senior executives made him realize all the more that his leaders were smart folks who wanted him to succeed. It went a long way toward breaking down the barriers that had built up between his field team and corporate headquarters. He was now ready to lead up the chain.